And it had begun in a moment. That moment in 1974, when his girlfriend, Marietta, later his wife, took him to see the Gibbons carvings behind the altar in St. James's Church, Piccadilly. He was thunderstruck, and his reaction was physical, hairs rising on his neck, his skin tingling, and his tongue seeming to move over ivory's coolness and smoothness. The thinking of the body, Yeats would have called it. His first academic thought was to write a book about Gibbons. His second was just to pick up tools and teach himself to carve. The minute his chisel struck the wood, he was enthralled. Ensconced in a cottage in Sussex for 8 years, then at Barneveld, he became a ghost's apprentice. But no, that put it too lightly. By the end of a decade, he was a slave. Enslaved not only to his carvings, which about halfway through would start to impose their own ideas on him, but also to the long-dead master he so revered, beside whose work he could only despair about his own. There was a way out. That, too, was completely unexpected. In 1986 he was asked to replace a 7-foot Gibbons drop at Hampton Court Palace, southwest of London, which had been destroyed by fire. He hesitated over it. Exact reproduction, which he had never done, was surely the most slavish tutelage of all. Yet the closer he got to Gibbons, first touching a single stem, then whole pieces, scrutinizing his technique, following the movements of his gouges and his thought, the more his own workbench seemed transported to 1698, and the more he saw the larval forms of the half-modelled wood with Gibbons's eyes. When, after a year, the drop was made, with its exhausting ropes of crocuses and trefoil, he was no longer a slave, but a colleague. The spell was broken.